is the Subcommittee of Human Services. It's February 19th, 2015. We have a public hearing today. We're looking forward to hearing from you. We have a lot of people signed up. I'm going to ask that as much as possible we hear from people who aren't normally in this building. Sorry that some of the lobbyists who are here every day probably feel like, what's he talking about? But I would really like to hear, and I think the panel would like to hear, from people who are outside this area, who have come along a long distance today, who we don't normally see. We really want to give priority to that. We're going to hold testimony to 2 minutes per person, simply because we have an hour and a half, maybe a little bit more, before some of us have to be on the floor. We have some important bills on the floor today, one of them called Cover Oregon. So several of us are carrying that bill and have to be on the floor to vote on it. So we will move through this and listen to you carefully. I'm going to ask the panel to try to refrain from asking questions because we haven't got time. And write your questions down, and we'll get back to them later. So all that said, let's start this. And what we'll do is we'll call you up, and we have several of you who are in panels, and we'll call you up in those panels so you can give your testimony as a group if you've signed up that way. Lori, anything else to add to that?
I don't think so, Mr. Pritchard.
Lori has a 2-minute timer here. When you go over the time, there's a drop box below you. But we will cut you off. For other people, we will cut you off. So we're going to have to do it that
Mr.
way.
Mr. Co-Chair, the way the timer works is it's set for 2 minutes. So you'll get a green light, and then the yellow light will go off when you're getting close. And when the red light goes off is when you're supposed to stop talking.
Thank you. So remember, there's other people who want to speak too, and we want to be polite to everybody, have everybody have a chance to be heard, and we will be listening carefully. So we're going to start off right away. I'm going to call up, and I hope I get these names right. Forgive me if I don't. Camille Foskett and Allison Faucher, F-A-U-C-H-E-R. Could you both come up, please? And what we're doing is like baseball. On deck will be, give me a panel here.
Okay.
Will be Carmen Corbin, Timothy Drowney, and Mohammed Bader. Those two will be on deck. So please start your testimony, please. When you're on deck, it just means that you got ready to come up. You'll know you're next up. Yes.
Hi, thank you, Mr. and Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Camille Foskett, and I represent Dungarvan, Oregon, an agency that supports individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We serve 50 individuals at 21 programs in Portland, Eugene, and Springfield. I just want to take a couple minutes of your time to discuss why we think House Bill 5026 is important. In short, we need to value the work and raise the wage. This statement embodies our campaign to increase wages for our beloved direct support professionals, known in the field as DSPs. The problem we want to solve is our relentless staff turnover. At Dungarvan last year, we had a horrifying 95% turnover rate. And according to exit interviews, over 75% of these voluntary terminations were because of the abysmally low pay and, in many cases, better job opportunities. This means we hire staff, we invest in training staff, and then we lose staff. Thus, we lose consistency in the delivery of care providing services, which has an extremely negative effect for the individuals that we support. At Dungarvan, and I'm sure the numbers are very similar with other agencies across the state, the average cost to train a new DSP is $4,000. According to my calculations, in Eugene and Springfield alone, Dungarvan lost $250,000 last year in training costs. Again, this figure is only for Lane County and does not include our other programs throughout the Portland metro area. This is no way to run a business, and we know it. If only we could take those constant costs from hiring and training and devote them to the increased DSP wages, we would be ahead. The average DSP in Oregon makes $10.80 an hour. That's only $1.55 more than minimum wage. DSPs are often responsible for life-sustaining supports to Oregon's most vulnerable populations. DSPs support individuals with extremely high behaviors, and that can and have caused severe and sometimes permanent injuries to their caregivers. DSPs also support individuals who are medically fragile, where they are literally holding lives in their hands. Hence, this field requires staff to be highly trained and have the fortitude to handle intense situations on a daily basis.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Am I over 2 minutes?
Yeah, it's 2 minutes.
It goes fast. Gosh, I didn't even see the red light.
Okay. Okay. We'll help you through it with everybody else also. And please give us your written testimony, too.
I'm sorry?
Give us your written testimony, too.
Okay.
And that goes for everybody here. We would like to look at your written testimony, so if we cut you off, we can look at that later and read through it and understand it better.
Okay.
All right.
For the
Introduce
record,
yourself.
My name is Allie Fauché from Portland, Oregon. Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, members of the committee. I'm an employment specialist at Dirks Counseling and Consulting, which is a provider of employment and vocational rehabilitation services for Oregonians with disabilities. So 2 years ago, Dirks began working on a pilot project with Oregon VR, Oregon Developmental Disabilities, and then several school districts. The goal of the pilot is to braid resources and establish service linkages for young people with developmental disabilities in transition schools. We want these people to begin to envision working to obtain competitive integrated employment before exiting their transition programs. So far we've been highly successful, but it requires a solid base of funding. So I want to share with you a student of mine at Centennial Transition Center, Bella. She has a developmental disability and she also struggles with anxiety. Her parents were able to witness Bella gain employment and move past her barriers. With the assistance of pilot partners, Bella is now a full-time employee at Regal Cinemas. She loves her job and she was even promoted. So now when Bella graduates in this June, she will not be sitting at home, she'll be working. Bella's mom wishes she could be here today, but she can't, so I'm going to read the following for her. I am a parent of 20-year-old daughter who is developmentally delayed. I cannot thank Dirks enough for all they have and continue to do to support my daughter in becoming an active and contributing citizen in our society. They have taken the time to get to know my child and encourage her every step of the way. My daughter has gained so much confidence in just the last 3 to 6 months. I love seeing my daughter so happy about earning her own money as well as making new friends. So I want to encourage the legislator to continue to provide funding to VR, DD, and the Department of Education so that we can continue these important services so that young people with disabilities can find stable, meaningful employment before leaving high school. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Your timing is excellent.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Okay. And coming up is Carmen Corbin, Timothy Drowney, and Mr. Batter. On deck, Chris Burnett, Maureen Gibson, and Jessica Leitner. So please come up. Introduce yourself and give us your testimony, please.
Good morning, co-chairs Bate and Representative Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Mohammed Bader. I'm a community developmental disabilities program manager in Multnomah County. I came here to talk with you really about a very significant issue, which is, again, you heard it earlier with other agency staff morale, and the fact that we are really overloaded with the advent of the community choice K plan and the many significant changes that we are doing with the developmental disability system in terms of equality and compliance with federal rules. I have two individuals with me here that are going to also give more details. Just to briefly, I want to talk about the fact that at this point, we don't have much of infrastructure to do a lot of the work we need to do. We are also having a lot of, like for example, in my program, about 14 people left our program. And in sum, what I like to say is that we reached to a point where we cannot make any additional workload simplification. And with that, I like, as a CDDB manager, to request the funding, the financing of, as reflected in the House Bill 2056 at 95% of the workload model. This will help us deliver much better services, much more responsive services to our families and communities, and will help the case managers stay on top of their cases. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Hello, Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson and other members of the committee. My name is Carmen Corbin, and this is Harry here, who may screech. I'm sorry. He does. Anyhow. See? Case in point. My name's Carmen Corbin. As I said, I'm the wife of an Oregon public school teacher and a stay-at-home mom. Two sons, ages 10, Jones, who I'll talk about in a second, and Harry here is 1.5. When my 10-year-old son, Jones, was 4.5, he started having seizures. He'll scream if you grow. Started having seizures, which also came with a host of developmental delays, countless hospitalizations, and several years of feeling like a blind person navigating what resources are out there. We found the one that I'm about to share with you a little bit more about. My son's cognitive delays have caused him a lot of marked difficulty with most tasks you and I usually take for granted, including taking care of this guy.
I'm a physician and I spend most of my time with kids.
That was enough to quiet him down on its own right there.
You're not too scared of me.
What do you think?
Nice try.
Okay, thank you. He needs assistance with everything from bathing to brushing teeth and frequent reminders to do so. In a lot of areas, he moves at about a level of a 4-year-old. Academically, he works at the skill level of a kindergartner and first grader on the subject, depending on the subject. Okay, shoot. Thanks, Harry. Okay, so struggles. Through this program, the K-Plan that we're here to talk about, we were able to hire a woman named Samantha who works with us about 80 hours per month during the school year and 100 hours during the summer. She met with us, is able to meet with us on some weekends and able to help us with a bunch of different skills she brings to the table. I found her by putting an ad in at one of the local university education programs, and it was amazing that this plan was able to find someone at such a skill level for us. Sammy provides something we cannot in the fact that she is an authority figure separate from his parents, associated with school in his mind, and has the time to learn about his idiosyncrasies that he can at school. He's majorly affected by seizures and the medications to control them constantly. It's very difficult, actually impossible for public school teachers to let him know. I just want to throw out one of the more other important little pieces. Can I throw out one more thing? I apologize. Basically, he, through public school, has allotted amounts of speech therapy, OT, things like that, normal pullouts in his self-contained classroom. He is allowed from 5, and this is an increase through the public school system, he was allowed 5 hours per year of occupational therapy, per year, and then it just went up to 7, but that's for the entire year, and he needs a lot of things like that, and that's the kind of thing that this plan can pay for. But he has seen, he's gotten a lot better since working with this program. I'll just end it there and give you my testimony.
I appreciate your testimony. I got the picture, and I think somebody needs some help over here.
Okay. Sorry, guys.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I love babies.
Next.
Okay. I love babies.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and good luck there. Yes.
Okay, good morning, Co-Chair Senator Bates and Representative Nathanson and the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Timothy Drown, and I'm a bilingual service coordinator for Multnomah County in the Developmental Disabilities Services Program. I started back in December of 2011 before the arrival of the K-Plan, and since then the scope of the work and the daily duties that we have changed substantially. For the first year, I assisted families to gather resources in the community and to help those children who went into crisis through short-term and long-term diversion funding. It was hit and miss, and we had to justify all that spending. I also wrote service plans with the family support monies, and through Medicaid, we helped our families with state plan personal care program. Since the arrival of the K-Plan 2 years ago, the nature of the work that I do with the county has changed drastically. In the past, our days were determined by providing services to our families, and those totals were counted each month. But since the arrival of the K-Plan, The time we have to directly serve the families has been reduced due to the large amount of administrative tasks that we have been assigned. The increased workload has been compounded by the requirement to do more than twice as many funded plans with monthly telephone calls and quarterly visits. While the influx of the CAVE plan has increased our ability to provide services, the implementation and administration of these new programs have impeded our ability to sustain and to increase the number of services that we provide. Serving more clients takes more human resources and takes more time doing such tasks as lengthy assessments, level of care assessments, detailed service plans,
I'm gonna ask you to close, okay? And give us your testimony.
Yes, sir.
Okay. We can make that happen. Thank you. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Chris Burnett, Maureen Gibson, and Jessica Littner. On deck, Brian Lewis, Matt Orser, and Ralph. I'm going to pass you up on this one because you're here all the time. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, I just got to interject in this.
You do?
If you don't mind. Yeah, okay. This won't take long. Of my 10 years that I've been in this building, I have never seen your technique with children like that.
I love kids, okay? Let's see. Whatever it takes.
I would just say 1.5 is a tough age.
Kid's a strong little guy. He's been set along and solidly built. Please start.
All right. My name is Maren Gibson. I'm a direct support professional for PCL. I've been there for 12 years. Good morning, Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, and members of the committee. I just want to talk to you a little bit about what we do. I was sitting here the other morning, and you asked the state, what does a direct support professional do? And it really just depends on who's in front of us. You know, if I'm supporting an older woman who likes to crochet and cook and go for walks around the block and picks flowers, that's what we do. And if she needs help changing her attends, or if she's, you know, deteriorating in her health and she's experiencing dementia or needs extreme medical care like catheters or medication administration that's a little more intrusive, that's what we do. And if in front of me is a young man that's experiencing, you know, being 21, 22, and 23. If what he wants to do is go to the bars and get a relationship and do that safely, that's what we do. We grow those critical thinking skills so that he can do that in a safe manner, you know, and join in with the general public, and so he's not ostracized, and so that's what we're doing for the day. And if the person that we're supporting is really struggling and really in crisis, that's what we do. Sometimes they're kicking and hitting and spitting on us. Sometimes we fear for our lives and we fear for their lives, and that's what we have to do. And so it's really hard as a direct support professional to drive down the road or be struggling in a physical restraint with somebody and see one of those guys flipping the sign for Hugo's Pizza. They're making more than us. You know, they make more money than we do per hour as direct support professionals, and that's hard. You know, we're doing the same things that nurses do, police officers, counselors, life coaches, and we're making just as much as a guy just standing out there holding a sign. And so what I'm asking now is just for a little more funding to get people that are willing to stay and willing to go through those crises to build that relationship. You know, the person does as well as their relationships are. Just like every person out there, if we're unhappy, we're not doing well. When they're unhappy, they're not doing well, and they need more funding, and they need more support. And it's our direct support professionals out there that build that relationship. And so please, give us a livable wage so we will stay and build those relationships.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Bates, and members of the committee, thanks for letting me speak with you this morning. I'm Jessica Leitner. I'm the Executive Director of Edwards Center. We're a nonprofit that's been serving adults with disabilities in Washington and Clackamas County since 1972. We provide 24-hour residential services, independent living, and in-home supports to families. We also provide employment supports at our plant in Beaverton. We have 18 locations, and we serve over 300 people. I speak for Edwards Center today, but also for all of the providers across Oregon who deliver similar supports. And I'm here to speak about the direct support professional wage. At Edwards Center alone, we've been carrying more than a dozen open positions. We've been continuously interviewing for those positions since September. The constant hiring process taxes our trainer. She's struggling to keep qualified people in open positions. Last month alone, the amount of wages that were expended in overtime would have paid for two full-time positions with benefits. At $10.80 an hour, we've been unable to attract qualified candidates, even those that meet minimum requirements, being 18, having basic command of the English language, and able to pass a criminal history check. Our applicants make it through one day of screening, and then they're sent out to shadow people, full-time employees on shift, and a lot of them just don't come back. They see the complexities of the job, requiring feeding, toileting, medications, and they just don't return to work the next day. The victims of this situation are the very adults we're trying to support. We're placing them at great risk. Employees working overtime are more likely to make medication errors, injure themselves, injure residents during routine procedures. The quality of their care is diminished, and those important relationships that have been formed are lost when our qualified professionals leave the workforce. So I implore you to please consider raising the direct support wage and show us how much we value the work here in Oregon that these folks do.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm hearing a theme here.
Good morning, committee and co-chair Gates and co-chair Nathan. My name is Chris Burnett. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. I think you know as well, our member agencies are all in your districts. Our constituents are in your districts, and they support constituents in your districts. The concerns I have to share with you today, there's two, and it cuts across all provider types, metro, rural, and all across the state of Oregon. These concerns threaten the stability of those agencies, their ability to expand capacity to meet the needs of the K plan, new federal regulations, and multiple system changes that are occurring at the same time. The nature of what has been historically a cutting edge, community focused set of services in Oregon that's based on individual choice is struggling due to all these changes. The direct support professional is on the front line of change. In 1996, the National Alliance of Direct Support Professionals ideological founder John F. Kennedy Jr. wrote that quality is defined at the point of interaction between the staff member and the individual with a disability. If you don't remember anything else I say today, I hope you remember that, because people like Marin and other DSPs like her are where quality is created in programs. There are an estimated 14,000 DSPs in Oregon supporting an estimated 6,000 individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. If we're going to keep having quality programs, we're going to dramatically need to increase the number of DSPs we have in the workforce. Nationally, there's a DSP workforce crisis. According to the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute's projections for Oregon, between 2012 and 2022, we will need to increase the number of direct care support staff by 22%. Demand for such specialized support work is in competition with the long-term care elderly population and other higher paying wage jobs. And I see I'm running out of time, so my ask is include some money in the budget based on DHS's estimates. That's a big ask, $36.8 million. I'll send you the testimony.
Send me the testimony. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time. We have your testimony already. Yes. So Brian Lewis, Matt Orser, and Ralph Groner. On deck, John Bartholomew, Stephanie Barnett Harrow, and Phil Bentley. Ralph, you get 30 seconds.
Mr. Chair, I'm Ralph Groner.
You're done.
These are the people who testify. 1 minute. I have to say I also work on IDD. We got to get the salaries up, the bottom line. We have the lowest salary in IDD of any of the comparable groups I've looked at, and the turnover is horrendous, and the training cost, yet the responsibility of my members is unbelievable. Two SACU they'll talk about, stabilization and crisis unit, I'm done.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Matt Orser. I'm the president of Ask Me Local 1246. I represent 558 employees. Since July last year, we've had 148 staffing injuries, and that's in the data of the tracking policy through July and June. An idea of how scary 148 injuries is 7 months in a policy year, and 2013 and 2014, there were a total of 213 staff injured. We had 18 injuries per month. Now we're up to 21 injuries per month. If this trend continues, SACU staff will essentially have a 50-50 chance of receiving an injury in the workplace. SACU employees have worked on an average of 12,000 hours of overtime a month. And this is people that are being mandatory daily, sometimes 3 days in a row. And if you do the math, there's no sleep for anybody in there. So we're wondering what we can do to get some workforce changes as far as that goes. It dwindles the care that we give our individuals, because if you're mandatory and it's 3 days in a row, that's 16 and 16 and 16, who's really suffering here? Yes, the staff is suffering, but our individuals are suffering because we might make a mistake in med errors. We might forget something in a care procedure that needs to be done. Something needs to be done. The clients of the stabilization and crisis units aren't the same from the former Fairview clients that we all remember. We are afraid that if we do not get the staffing and work protections that AskMe is working on, the injuries will continue to get worse. Please work with us and properly fund and staffing stabilization. Thank you for your time, and obviously we won't be doing questions today.
No kidding. Thank you. Good job.
Thank you, Senator Bates and Representative Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Lewis, and I am an employee with the Stabilization and Crisis Unit and a member of my local's 1246 union board. Obviously, many people, both in the private sector and in our state program, are calling the red flag for staffing and for funding, and I'm here also. I will try to moderate my comments to keep it under the 2 minutes. I will do that. The overtime is clearly the issue. In fact, as a member of my local's board, I sounded the alarm for three different administrators who span about 4.5 years. It was actually the administrator that had noted that our plan for two vacation reliefs per house per 10 staff, one per 10 staff, was just not enough to deal with the normal absences. So what our ask today is to point out the numbers that we have in the people in crisis thing that we gave you, and what my colleague Matt gave you as well. We need to use the overtime that's being paid, which is about $4 million a year, and turn that into at least the equivalent of 125 additional folks to staff our program. We actually need twice that number, but at least using what we're using now would be better and a great start for helping our program. We have a lot of problems with staff who are not covered, and that absence is where we get those injuries that my colleague Matt was talking about. This problem is a national problem, as has been said. I have a cousin whose knee was broke, and he was out of work for 6 months for the same type of issue, not enough staffing. So please work to increase support for us and the private sector.
Thank you all for your testimony and great timing. Good job. John Bartholomew, Stephanie Barnett Caro, and Phil Bentley. On deck, Melissa Unger, Carmen Morales, and Judy Richards.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Bartholomew, Public Policy Director at AARP Oregon. And today I'm speaking on behalf of the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities, which is a coalition of industry, labor, consumer advocates, and others to speak together about long-term supports and services and other issues related to aging and disability. We've submitted some written testimony that has some details on from the campaign with their letterhead that indicates our consensus position on the DHS APD budget. First, let me thank you for your support for seniors and people with disabilities through the what's called the Senior SPA, Special Purpose Appropriation, from last session, and for ongoing support over the years. Items in that Senior SPA really were a welcome investment in our families and supports to ensure that people can live with dignity, independence, and choice. And we're pleased that the governor's recommended budget continued many of the DHS current spending levels, but there were several, and including several items in the senior spa that were intended to be ongoing investments, including resources to Oregon Project Independence and senior and disabled transportation needs. There's several items that we urge you to consider, including in the in your budget as you move forward that were not in the GRB. They're listed on the one pager that we provided as testimony, but they include continuing the training for family and professional caregivers, continuing the Oregon Project Independence pilot project for younger disabled individuals, and continuing the evidence-based health promotion and disease prevention. We're also supporting COLAs for long-term care providers, and Phil will talk about that a little bit. And lastly, we want to say that the GRB included $35 million to deal with changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act. Well, you know, issues there. We're encouraging $18 million and holding $17 in reserves.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, and we'll be seeing you again.
You will.
Good morning. Co-chairs Senator Bates and Representative Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stephanie Barnett Harrow. I'm the project director of the Geriatric Medication Training Initiative through Oregon Care Partners. I'm testifying today to ask for continued funding for Oregon Care Partners Caregiver Training Initiative, share some of our successes to date, and illustrate the benefits of the important initiative for all Oregonians. A little bit about myself. I'm a former police officer. I've spent over 15 years working with older adults and individuals with developmental disabilities, including time as a memory care assisted living administrator. And I hold a Master of Arts in Gerontological Counseling and have had several years of experience training individuals in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. Like the rest of the country, Oregon is preparing to care for a rapidly aging population. The number of Oregonians over the age of 65 by the year 2020 is expected to increase by 63%. Ensuring aging Oregonians live with dignity, respect, and the care they deserve requires the support and care of whole communities, including doctors, nurses, first responders, loved ones, and family members. In 2014, the Oregon Legislature funded a caregiving training initiative to address the overwhelming need for specialized training on caring for aging Oregonians and to provide additional community resources for family caregivers. Oregon Care Partners' goal is to improve care for aging Oregonians by helping both professional and family members understand how to manage care, services, and support for the people they care for and love. Oregon Care Partners trainings are free and open to the public and are available through June 30th, both online and in person, throughout the state of Oregon. Training specifically help the following groups: professional caregivers, doctors, nurses, long-term care providers who are facing new challenges due to our aging population and the increase of Alzheimer's disease, first responders, police officers, sheriffs, firefighters, EMTs, EMS workers, who are the first to respond to a silver alert in the case of an emergency. And according to the Alzheimer's Association in 2010, approximately 70% of those living with Alzheimer's disease are living in the community versus long-term care facilities. Family caregivers are in the thousands in Oregon.
Sorry,
there are currently about...
I'm sorry, we're going to stop you, so
okay.
Wrap it up, please.
You all have our testimony, so thank you for your time.
And thank you for your time, and thank you for your testimony. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Phil Bentley with the Oregon Healthcare Association, and I will try to be Ralph Groner fast this morning. I'm here basically to lend our support to the priorities that John outlined in the, for the campaign, as well as the Oregon Care Partners Caregiver Training Initiative that Stephanie outlined. That is one of our four budget priorities for this session. I just want to highlight two more very quickly here. There's been a lot of discussion about turnover rates and compensation in the workforces for caregivers, and our members employ thousands of caregivers throughout the state. Therefore, we feel it's critical to provide a COLA to the reimbursement rate under Medicaid for long-term care services and supports at 2.5% per year. We'd also like to see a continuation of a grant through the Innovations Fund at DHS for Our House, which is doing an innovative program helping to care for people with AIDS and HIV in the community there. And that will conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And thanks for the extra moments, okay? Thank you. Melissa Unger, Carmen Morales, and Judy Richards. On deck, John Mullen, Judith Voss, and Katie Rose.
Good morning, co-chairs. My name is Carmen Morales Mayoral. I am a case manager for the aging and people with disabilities in DHS. I'm also a member of SEIU Local 503. I've been doing this work for almost 20 years. I love my job, and it is important to me because I feel that I'm making a difference in the lives of Oregonians. It is my passion to work with seniors and to get to know their needs. I get to be the person that connects them to resources when they need at the time that they need it the most. It is so important that they know that someone cares about them and it is in their sight. Whether it's in person or over their phone, I try to connect with them and show that someone cares. The system of care in Oregon has changed people's lives and is a unique and important because without them, seniors would not be able to survive. I've seen firsthand how many of the clients that I serve are able to receive the care in the setting of their choice. For many of them, it means remaining at home with home care assistance. They get to maintain control of their lives and their independence. Seniors get to make a choice where they are going to live in the last day of their lives. And to me, that is priceless. The decision you make in this building have a very real impact in the lives of our seniors and the work that I'm able to do on their behalf. Staffing for case managers is an ongoing issue. Caseloads have improved over the last biennium, but there is still a huge problem with case managers have 2.5 times the caseloads than they should. What this means is that I cannot give each client the time they need and deserve. As case managers, my colleagues and I have to attend care conferences, have to make appropriate referrals, make monthly contacts with each seniors in our caseloads and to their care providers. We don't have the privilege to cut corners because the phone call that we make every month may be the only one that they get.
I'm going to have to cut you off, Carmen.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I particularly like hearing from people like Carmen that we don't normally have a chance to listen to, so I will give you a little extra leeway there.
I wanted to add that our caseload is huge, and it makes a big impact the decisions that you make here. So please don't forget our seniors because they are part of our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Carmen. Melissa.
Senator Bates.
Not down a minute and a half because she
I know. Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I will try to be quick. I'm actually testifying today because Rebecca Sandoval, a home care worker from Medford, was unable to come testify about the Department of Labor ruling for the Fair Labor Standards Act. So, while I'm up here, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the SEIU Local 503 Political Director, and we represent the whole spectrum of caregivers and direct support and direct frontline staff at DHS. So I really want to try to just do two quick things on the FLSA ruling that you all heard so much about the other day. The fact is, the federal ruling simply says that caregiving is work, and it should be treated as such. And I think that we all generally agree with that if we have cared for children or cared for seniors, and we agree that it is work. However, the challenge is that Oregon has created a very unique system of live-in caregiving, and as far as we know, we are the only state in the system that has done this. And there are 2,000 live-in caregivers that provide critical work. They're 10% of the overall amount of home care workers, but they account for 85% of the cost of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And the reason is this, is one, people might think that the impact of the Fair Labor Standards Act is overtime, but it's actually paying for all hours worked. So let me tell you a quick story about Rebecca Sandoval, who was supposed to be here today. She currently couldn't be here because her client is sick. Her consumer is sick. She is too sick to travel, and she's too sick to be away from for 1 hour. Rebecca gets paid for just the amount of hours her consumer is assessed. That is 10 hours a day. Rebecca has not slept more than 2 hours in weeks. But she only gets paid 10 hours a day, and she gets paid sub-minimum wage for the 10 hours that she works a day. And she can't leave her client because there was not a relief worker to help her. That is what the Department of Labor ruling is really about. It is really about Rebecca Sandoval and her ability to do her work. We believe that there are good solutions that we can work through with you, but that is what that ruling is really about. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to point out some of you signed up in three places. I'm just sorting this through now, so I'll be changing things a bit. And we actually limited your testimony because of the number of people, and some of you duplicated and triplicated yourself. So I'm not sure what's going on, unless we have three of you out here with the same name, which seems unlikely.
They cloned.
So, or they got cloned. I don't know what's going on.
It's like multiplicity.
Please introduce yourself to the family. I want to hear from you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Bates and Co-Chair Representative Nathanson. I did not sign up three times. I am not going to talk three times. For the record, my name is Judy Richards, and I am from Salem. I am representing seniors and people with disabilities. I am on the advisory council for Northwest Senior and Disability Services. I would like to advocate to you all today for the continued investments to our area agencies on aging and disabilities. This is an investment that can lower the overall health care costs by keeping seniors and people with disabilities healthier longer, and by using programs that are evidence-based, improving the quality of life by early intervention. These programs are so valuable, and we are seeing the proof of it every day. These programs include options counseling for seniors and people with disabilities and the families. This service provides information, referrals, and education to the underrepresented. The ADRC, Aging and Disability Resource Connection website, is easy to navigate, or the consumer may call the 800 number for a friendly, reassuring voice or a contact point. This program has proven to be successful by seniors and people with disabilities who utilize it and trust it. Consumers report that they have better control over making decisions on what to do next. Gatekeeper program, training people in the community to be aware of urgent issues. A short story about Meals Program volunteer who noticed after several days in a row of two people who were just throwing the food away as he delivered it, and discovered that they had Alzheimer's and needed help. That is work. The OPI pilot funding program provided also now for our people with disabilities who are younger. That is a valuable program that we have waited long for. I ask for your continued support and investments, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you very much for your testimony, especially about OPI. We really appreciate it. Thank you. John Mullen, Judith Voss, and Katie, we're moving you to another panel, Eva Ripitow. I may have gotten that name wrong.
Katie, you were on here a couple different times. I don't see what. Did you mean to be in the panel or by yourself? I don't know if you mean this.
Katie Rose. Is Katie Rose here?
Yeah, I'm right here. Sorry.
So you want to be part of the panel that Leslie put together? Is that okay? So we don't need to do her separately.
I said that. Eva Ripitow, is she here?
Yeah, she's right there.
Come on up. John, lead us off.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. I'll be brief, but I want to touch on a couple of points here. As I think the committee is well aware, the special purpose appropriation came from savings out of the senior medical deduction. Those savings continue to grow. And so I fully support the campaign's testimony about the additional investments that they speak about in that particular testimony. I want to also just touch on three things very quickly. The general assistance study, you all heard about that, and know that we have a bill in the works, and we're going to have some discussion in the substantive committee on March the 4th. I want to touch on the property tax hardship deferral program. We have a waiting list for people that are eligible, but there's no funds. Those funds have been exhausted. That's also in the campaign's testimony. But we also hope that if there's a SPA rebalance in this biennium, that we'll be able to loosen up some dollars to work with those people on a waiting list. And the final thing that I'll mention is that before I came to work with the Oregon Law Center, I was involved with wanting to see OPI become an age-neutral program. I'm on the stakeholder group for the OPI program for younger people with disabilities, and I'm really very supportive of that continuing. Glad to see it in the co-chair's budget. Thank you very much.
Constantine.
Do I just start? Okay. Well, I just want to thank you all very much, and I honor the work that you do. My name is Judith Voss. I'm from Eugene. I'm a parent of an adult with developmental disabilities, and I'm also a professional in the field with a doctorate in special education, and I am here to advocate for increased wages of direct care staff. I have seen the firsthand results of the lack of adequate wage for direct care staff. I quickly identified, my daughter's been in a group home for 2.5 years, and I quickly identified the core problem of the systemic dysfunction being the lack of an adequate wage. The turnover rate is astronomical, as you know. In a 1-year period, there were 35 direct care staff in my daughter's house. 19 of those were either voluntary or involuntarily terminated. In a 2.5-year period, there were 8 substantiated protective services reports of physical, emotional abuse, neglect, and theft directly related to my daughter. There's two kinds of people that are drawn to be a direct care staff. One is the kind we've heard about who are 18, and I mean, this is a generalization, who have no other, you know, can go work as a sign waiver or in fast foods, and the other is somebody like our dedicated people. 12 years is just, this is a hero, this is an angel here in our midst. And I have seen the result of the revolving door, and many of people in group homes don't have family, they don't have friends. Their direct care staff are their family, are their friends, and it's a continual cycle of crisis and stability and crisis and stability every time someone leaves their lives. My slogan is raise the pay and let the good ones stay. It's unconscionable that the good ones have to go to a food pantry to feed their families. They have to get second jobs to feed their families. They have to work overtime to the point that they aren't sleeping. It's just unconscionable. And it's time that we recognize, honor, celebrate, and adequately compensate those who devote their lives and service to others. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Chair Bates, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thanks so much for your time. My name is Eva Ripito. I'm with Oregon AFSCME, and I had a special request from one of our local 88 members to come and testify about the need for more funding to help with implementation of the K plan. She said that this has meant access to funding for thousands of families that had no previous access to services, which is great. But the difficult part is that the state has not built in any infrastructure to implement and manage access to these services, and it's fallen to the counties and brokerages to implement and manage this huge new system without any additional funding. Counties are struggling to get assessments completed, Medicaid eligibility figured out, care plans written, services authorized, support workers crime checked and entered into the system, and services paid for, all within the strict timelines and no additional FTE and minimal training. She references the workload study and is asking that we try to fund the workload model close to 100% as possible, which would allow counties to hire additional staff needed to manage this new approach to services. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for testimony. We are getting the message, I believe, here, okay? Ross Ryan, Leslie Sutton, Katie Rose, and Ruth Geisinger. And on deck, Carrie Buck, Paul Patridge, Noel Sisk, and Emily Bramman.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Sutton. I represent the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. It's a coalition of over 30 organizations that promote services, equality, and community inclusion for people with developmental disabilities and their families. The IDD Coalition envisions an Oregon where all people are valued and granted equal opportunity to be members of their community. A fundamental piece of this is housing. The governor's budget completely removes a very valuable housing resource, which is the Fairview Trust. Most of you have our testimony. You're very familiar with what this is. As a quick summary, the Fairview Trust is a promise in Oregon law that Oregonians with intellectual and development developmental disabilities would have access to community housing resources. This was a promise that was created after the sale of the Fairview Training Center, where Oregon segregated people with developmental disabilities away from their families and their communities for over a century. The trust was truly an opportunity to try to make good out of what was really bad public policy at the time. This is a commitment that we have made over and over to Oregonians, and we see the continued need for community housing today, especially when we hear from families and self-advocates who are working toward building an independent life. The culture shift has changed nationally and also within Oregon, and people are looking to have independent living situations. We have supports that can support them to do that. The catch for so many people is access to affordable housing. And truly, the Fairview Trust can help make a difference in those people's lives. And so we do ask that you definitely fund the $12 million that was originally in it. I will also quickly mention, in 2011, there was a loan taken from the trust. It was characterized as a loan in DHS end-of-session memos. And also, some people in this building have also gone on the record saying that that was a loan at the time and that we should commit to, again, bringing that that trust back up to $12 million, which is where it was originally. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Ross Ryan, speaking on behalf of the Fairview Trust Fund. And I'm also speaking on behalf of the Coalition of the Self-Advocacy Group.
Mr. Ryan has asked that I ask him questions to help support him in his testimony today, so
thank
I'm
you.
Going to start with some
thank
questions. You. Ross, why is it important for you to live in your community?
To live in the community means that we are being like everybody else, and we have a right to live independently as we can with our own communities, because it will also help to promote independence.
Is it easy for you to find affordable housing?
No, because it has to do with our wages.
If you don't have affordable housing, what happens?
We'd be out in the street, or we'd be in a group home of some form.
How do you see the Fairview Trust helping people with IDD?
It would bring the independence. And it will also show that the Senate is doing what they said they were going to do.
And how do you feel about the trust being zeroed out?
That should not be zeroed out, because we'll be taking 3 to 4 steps backwards. And thank you for your time.
Ross, thank you for your testimony.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Katie Rose, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Support Services Association, representing the 13 primarily nonprofit support services brokerages. The brokerages were formed out of the Staley Settlement in 2000 to facilitate services to adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities living primarily in their own or their family homes. We currently support over 7,500 individuals who in turn employ over 9,000 personal support workers. Brokerages take a progressive approach to serving Oregonians with a focus on helping people live the lives of their choosing. I have 2 requests of you today. First, in the governor's proposed budget, you'll see a line item to fund the workload model at 95%. The workload model is new to the DD field. The modeling was done in May 2014 prior to the September implementation of DHS's express payment system and the requirement to double the number of provider payrolls that we conduct each month. We are currently committing major resources and FTE to new express maintenance and interface responsibilities presently unfunded. Because of this, even small reductions to the model's funding percentage will result in a cut to brokerage funding from this biennium to the next. Coming at a time of heavily increased responsibility, a funding loss would be extremely detrimental to our ability to serve people. So we ask that you please support the governor's budget allocation of the new workload model funded at 95%. My second request is more modest. The Community First Choice K-Plan requires choice. And currently, brokerages have cap capacity, and some people are waiting for our services. We request that you would please add a budget line, budget note directing ODDS to open enrollment to brokerages, assuring choice in case management. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you.
My name is Ruth Geisinger. I'm from the brokerage. And the brokerage helped me out because of my disability that I'm having. If I wasn't in their brokerage, I'd be dead right now. But I'm not going to say that because I have issues. And they keep me alive with my brokerage because they're the one that saved me. I'm not harming myself so much and not being suicidal. And they're the one that tell me that I need good. I have talked to my brokerage every single day, maybe a phone call. Once a week, a phone call from my brokerage just to say, hi, I'm still alive, what's up, you know? Just talking to them has made me feel a lot better to have them. Right now, I have two caregivers, and they're ICSIU members, Local 503, and they're helping me out with all my needs that I need. It's really good to have a brokerage because they help you outside of the community. I know I live in a group home or a nursing home right now. I want to live in a place where I'd be a lot safer to live in my own apartment or live somewhere where I can live, because it's hard for anybody to understand that you might have a young kid that have disability. It's hard for them because they have to go outside and work. I worked 22 years at Oregon Health Science Center in Dornbecker Hospital. I know how hard it is to work. And I know how it feels to be frustrated, but you know, I'm a winner, not a loser. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony, especially Ross and especially Ruth. Thank you very much for both of you coming today. Carrie Buck, Paul Patridge, Noelle Sisk, and Emily Brahman. And on deck, Mike Oliver, Justin Conley, and Alan Smith.
Okay, we didn't talk about order at all.
Hello, I'm Carrie Buck. I'm the program manager down in Klamath County for the Community Developmental Disabilities Program, which I'll call the CDDP, hopefully without being tongue-tied through the rest of this. I've been asked by the Association of Oregon Counties to address the value of implementing the workload model funding formula for CDDPs in Oregon. Specifically, I'd like to address eligibility programming and licensing and certification for foster homes. The brokerage is hitting on a lot of the case management functions, which is a huge part of what we do. And Paul is speaking to protective service functions, which is also what we do. So what I'm hoping is that with the workload model implemented, we will be able to address our eligibility issues, which simply are, there's too much to do and not enough people to do them. We can't make any of the federal timelines. We don't make the state timelines. We know we're out of compliance. We're doing the best we can. The workload model really looks at what you do and pays for it, and I'm hoping that that would solve that issue. Our workload ineligibility is increasing. The K plan that people have been talking about really has changed the numbers of folks coming in the door. Not necessarily all getting eligible, but they're coming in the door and we still have to address it. The other thing I want to address is that Oregon has never funded licensing and certification for foster homes. I've been doing this for 25 years, and we've robbed Peter to pay Paul to get that done, because it is a necessary residential option for folks with disabilities. Licensing to me is much more of a program than an actual task. It is developing a system that can provide residential care for folks. It is literally, the county is the exec director for a whole residential component of our system. Foster care, I believe, is really, really important. because of my experience and what it can do for people. And I just have one quick example. I have a home in Klamath County that I call my fraternity house, and it has three grown men with intellectual disabilities in the home who live with a foster provider who happens to be a monk from Tanzania, and they have the best rhythm of life I've ever seen. When you're thinking a young 30-year-old man, these guys ride their bike to work and back. They go out fishing on weekends. Their house is always clean when I visit. They're all helping with dinner. They're all clean, doing their chores. They're getting ready because a girlfriend's coming over, so the living room has to look good, blah, blah, blah.
Thank you.
Foster care.
Okay,
good. Good morning, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson. My name, for the record, is Paul Partridge. I'm a program manager with Yamhill Community Developmental Disabilities Program, or Yamhill CDDP. I also happen to be a native Oregonian of seven generations, and I've been in the field for 22 years, starting from direct services all the way through managing a program. I spent about a decade of my career investigating abuse of our vulnerable population. So I want to talk mostly about that, but also about the impact of the increasing demands that Mr. Bader spoke to and that Ms. Buck spoke to. CDDPs are charged with conducting investigations of reported abuse and neglect of vulnerable populations, but also not only investigating abuse, but we're charged with following up on every report that comes through. Not every one of those needs to be investigated, but they all need to be followed up on. We have very well-trained staff in Oregon. I think we're the best-trained abuse investigators in the nation. And we just want to have the staffing to be able to do the work the way that we've been trained to do it. The second point really is around stewardship. And it really is around the system changes that we have undergone and that we continue to undergo. What we found is we have found ourselves with an increasing need for personnel to operationalize these system changes and to keep up with the demand. We just currently don't have the revenue to hire the staff that are needed to do the work. We want to be able to ensure not only health and safety, but we want to really ensure stewardship. We want to make sure that every dollar that's getting spent on people's services is actually getting spent on those services that are approved and authorized. So funding the workload model at the recommended 95% equity level would provide the CDDPs the personnel needed to accomplish these things. Thank you.
Cut you off there, and thank you very much. I think we have your written testimony. Thank you.
He'll be following.
Okay. Yes.
Good morning, Representative Nathanson, Senator Bates, and members of the committee. My name is Noelle Sisk, and I am here from Portland, Oregon. I'm the single mom of three, and my oldest daughter, Olivia, is 11 and experiences multiple disabilities along with intellectual disability. The first diagnosis I received for her was 20 weeks into my pregnancy when it was shown that she would experience brain abnormalities. The years of isolation I experienced after that were devastating. The medical impact, the navigating the hospital system, and it really, I struggled with inclusion for her. I was denied from multiple different preschools, was unable to get her involved in community, and then most hurtfully, it was hard to get her involved with church. When I became active with our local family network, that was definitely a point in her and my life that changed. It gave us access to information. It gave us access to having a vision. She now experiences inclusion in school and in our community. Family networks not only support families, but meaningful support for all families looks different. And what is that going to look like? We want to make sure that families have a vision for their child's future. We also work with community partners such as the Portland Children's Museum, YMCA's, Parks and Rec. We do inclusion and disability awareness for Intel, Boys and Girls Club, school district hospitals, CDDPs, and of course, as we all remember, the amazing Alaska Airlines that we did a couple years ago will be happening again in another month. And it's not only an amazing experience for families, but for for the crews that will be flying throughout the country and the thousands of families they'll impact to just allow something as simple as travel. Formal systems are an amazing help, but we really need peer support. Meeting another family that had a child experiencing disability to help me navigate that is what changed my life. I ask you to fully fund family networks in Oregon. It's empowering families that is raising empowered children that are growing into empowered adults who will expect the amazing things that you have that we submitted here with the statistics of those families coming in contact. So thank you for hearing me today.
Well, thank you for coming. We especially like to hear from people like you. I fly in Alaska once a week. Great airline.
You want my daughter next to you, I know.
No, maybe not, but they do offer that glass of wine after two, so that helps out.
Big plus.
Yes. But thank you for coming. We especially like hearing from people like you. Thank you for taking your time to come down here. It's really appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Nathanson, Senator Bates, and members of the committee. Hello, my name is Emily Brayman, and I am a mom of two girls, ages 7 and 8. We live in St. Helens, Oregon, which is out in Columbia County, and today I'm obviously here as a mom. Try not to. My youngest daughter experiences Down syndrome and is currently in second grade at McBride Elementary. Eden requires eyes on supervision at all times, as it is her favorite thing to try to escape day or night, whether mom is awake or not, home, school, wherever she is. Prior to the expansion of Kids Developmental Disability Services and the K plan you've been hearing about, I was an exhausted, on the edge, frantic mom. I rarely got a good night's sleep because my daughter, as I said, would escape. And there was one morning at 1 o'clock in the morning, I heard my car horn honking in the driveway. Mm-hmm. And I had motion detectors, door alarms, and child safety knobs. So, sleep was just not something I was used to. I was also unable to get the support of even my family members because they were paranoid they were going to lose her. And the few times they agreed to watch her, she did get out. One of the parts, this is where I thought I'd start crying, that hurt the most was watching my older daughter start to act out because mommy only paid attention to Sissy. And my older daughter didn't get one-on-one time. We couldn't go practice soccer because I always had to be ready to leave at a moment's notice for when Sissy ran. However, that was before. Now we have had K-Plan services for just over a year, and our household and our family life has changed dramatically. I now have... Through the environmental modifications, we have cameras in our house, I have more motion detectors, and I have these lovely things called Door Guardian deadbolts. I can go to sleep now knowing that if my daughter wakes up, I will be alerted, and if she wakes up, she cannot get out of my house. Much better. We also, through attendant care, my daughter has a personal support worker in our home almost every night, or every day, who... can help support her and give her assistance. Therefore, I can now do homework with my older daughter, go practice soccer, or just sit and talk with her, which is so valuable to a little child. So I just want to thank you for the opportunity to share. And as you make just budget decisions in the coming or for the coming 2 years and you think about kids, DD services, and K plans, think of my family, the dramatic effect it's had on us and all other families. And if I could, I wanted to add one thing. I told my older daughter why I was coming here today, and she gave me a big hug, and she said, "You need to go do that, Mom. I love the people that come help Eden." So thank you.
Emily, thank you very much. Emily, I tell you, the testimony we get from people like you is more important. Nothing gets out of anyone's head, but people who actually receive the services. We had a huge fight about the K waiver. I'm so glad we did it for people like you.
Thank you.
I'd also say, as the father of four girls who are now grown through their teenage years, there were times I needed those locks too.
I have them ready to go already.
Mike Oliver, Justin Conley, Alan Smith. And next up are going to be Sean Nordurft, Emily Brayman, and Camille Foskett, if I got those names correct.
I think
we had Camille first. She's on for twice.
And Emily was on that last panel, so I think maybe.
She just did it.
It's a little hard to keep up when people sign up for three different. So, please.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Bates, Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Oliver. I'm the president of the Community Providers Association of Oregon. We are a group entering our 30 years of bringing together providers and representing them in the fields of developmental disabilities. Our providers members also have contracts in the APD area, as well as voc rehab. I'm here today primarily to address the ODDS budget. And quite frankly, you've heard a lot of really what we're interested in. We were, as a group, most excited to review Governor Kitzhaber's budget and find for the first time, literally in probably four or five sessions, not only level funding, but a provision that would provide a 4% across the board rate increase to our member organizations. You've heard already today, and I only want to weigh in our organization support, A, for how critical that is, but B, how it will not close the gap on the wage issues that you've already talked about. We are, again, very concerned moving forward about the integrity of the community system that has been put in place since the early 80s in Oregon. I really have very little, and I'd like to defer my time to the other speakers to add to the stories you've already heard about the consequences and the impact, both in terms of client outcomes, but also in terms of operational outcomes for our provider companies. So I really won't say more about that right now, other than I'm really hopeful in the 15-17 biennia, not only can we find some stability, but also move forward with the whole question of equity and payment, same pay for same work, so on so forth. And with that, I'll just close defer the time to others. Thank you very much for the opportunity today
Thank
to
you.
Speak to you.
You guys got 15 extra seconds. Nice.
I did what I could.
Hello, my name's Alan Smith. I'm a parent of a daughter with Down syndrome. Thank you, Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, and the committee for hearing my testimony. Emily's 36 years old now and has been receiving various services from the state all of her life since birth. And, you know, I have to say that I'm so grateful. It's, you know, it's made all the difference in her life. She's, you know, she's an amazing person, a member of the community. I'm very proud of her. And, you know, a lot of getting her to that point is thanks to the support professionals that have worked with her over the years. And I guess I kind of want to emphasize the point of the people that are doing this work. And you know, when you pay someone a minimum wage, it sort of gives you the impression, well, this is an unskilled job, and nothing could be further from the truth. It's absolutely not. And you know, there have been other more articulate people, you know, expressing all of the different kinds of work that they need to do and that they do. We have a woman now who works with Emily and is helping her to learn independent skills, learning how to, you know, shopping, cooking, taking care of herself, with the goal of becoming more independent than she already is. And she's already pretty independent. Anyway, you know, this is one of many people who are working with us, and you know, I'm so grateful. I just want to hug her sometimes, but you know, hugs only go so far. I mean, that's they need more of a reward than that. The other thing I wanted to say is in terms of you know, the hardship. You know, over the years, obviously, we've had turnover in staff, and that's it's a difficulty for Emily, for you know, for the people that work with her, for her coworkers at her job.
I appreciate your testimony, and no one's more articulate than a parent of one of these children. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
My name's Justin Connolly. I am from Corvallis, Oregon, and I am part of the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition. it is important for me to work in my community. It makes me meet new people, helps me with my bills. Work keeps me somewhat stable in my home.
Sure.
I need money to live my life. My job now is maintaining the Corvallis Sports Park. I like my job. I work with a team of people. I keep the turf in the arena up to date once a week. I encourage my coworkers because we are all a team. We make only minimum wage, but I only work an hour and a half a week. My dream job is working for the football department at Oregon State. It would be great. I have experience that would help me. I was a manager for the basketball and football team in my high school. I ran out the water on the field. I put the balls away. I can do that, and I have done it. I have something to offer Oregon State. I need a job coach to help me and make sure I'm doing my job right. I would need a job coach at Oregon State too. Funding is really important. Without funding, we can't get the help we need. People want to go bigger and better than what they are doing, but they need the funding to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we could have used you during the Super Bowl. The ball. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you. Next up is Grant Renfro, Ruth Geisinger, and Sean Nordert. Mm-hmm. The panel, we're just about going to finish on time the way it looks here, if everything goes well. Hi.
Hello.
The other two panel members, other two members, I just called their names out. Do they hear it? Are you Grant?
I'm Sean.
You're
My
Sean.
Name is Sean Nopdirt.
Okay.
I'm a DSP.
Yeah, Grant Renfro, are you still here? Please.
All right.
Please
As I said, that. I'm a DSP. I've been working for the Oregon Supported Living Program for 21 years. I work in a group home with three men who have significant disabilities, two of whom have very deep mental health issues. It's a very difficult job. It's a very taxing job. It's also a very beautiful job. Unfortunately, however, it's not compensated for what it's worth. Obviously, that's what everyone is here saying. There's a lot of talk that I've heard amongst other legislators about bringing good jobs to Oregon. I support that. I support education as well. But I'd like to point out that there are good jobs in Oregon right now, and I know this because I have one. I've had it for 21 years. And after 21 years, I make $11.90 an hour, which is higher than the average, but it ain't much. I'm an anomaly. There are not a lot of people like me that have worked there this long. That's a problem. There are people who want to work there for a lifetime, that want to choose it as a profession, but simply cannot afford to. That is in your hands. So what I'm asking is not only that you increase the rates for the providers of group homes, but for all caregivers, and that there be something that attaches that money to wages. That's it. Thank you.
I understand your testimony, and thank you very much. That is an issue. Yes, sir.
I'm Grant Renfro, and I'm here about elder abuse. I have pastored a small church for almost 30 years, and about a year ago, our good friends, the finest people that you'd ever meet, the best friends we've ever had, were put in assisted care by their son and his wife. About the 7th of April, I called the elder abuse line and reported a problem. The bank had reported a problem also. And in this, it showed a lot of weakness and a lot of incompetence. Now, these people were put in there, and they definitely did not want to be there. They were practically taking care of themselves until she fell and was diagnosed with a stroke. And but I called up and told them, I said, I have got to talk to you about this because I'm going in for open heart surgery tomorrow morning. And they absolutely refused to take my call. I finally said, lady, you're it. You have to take what I'm going to tell you. And I explained the situation to her. When I got out of the hospital and got back on my feet a little bit, I started to follow up on it. And I got a hold of Scott Bond and talked to him. I talked to him, I think, three times. I was just like a pesky fly to him, and he let me know it.
Sir, I like now, it. Could you bring that particular case to us away from a public hearing so we can actually look into it for you? I'd like to see what happened, why you didn't receive help on it, and make sure that family's okay.
Can I read you just a short piece?
Absolutely, but I'd like to have you do more than just give us public testimony. I'd like to hear it in private because we don't want those people's names out there, obviously.
I will do that. I think that the laws need to be changed because at the present time, they can get a power of attorney over people and abuse them through it. In this couple's case, they took $34,000 out of their bank account, moved them into an assisted care, and sold their house for $220,000, and they're with it right now.
Elder abuse, especially financial abuse, is a huge problem in our state. We're working on it, and I'd like to hear more about that case privately. Please come talk to you.
Mr. Chair,
thank you very much.
Just follow up on that.
Yeah.
With what Mr. Renfro, Pastor Renfro was just talking about. Representatives Hoyle and Gilliam do have some bills that we're working on right now in judiciary.
Thank you.
That would kind of address
some of these issues.
Right.
I know it's a huge problem. Is there anyone here who failed to sign up or who did sign up and we missed? I want to make sure we have everyone here. We've done a good job of getting out on 10 here. I know we cut some people off to get there, and I apologize for that, but we wanted to hear from everybody who wanted to speak. So we've missed anyone, if we failed to bring anybody up who wanted to speak. Thank you. Panel, some of this is pretty heartrending, and it tells you why we're here doing what we're doing. Any questions from the panel now at all?
Just a thanks to everybody for taking the time to come today, as our, as the chair already said. But as I said to one of the folks who just testified, this is why we do what we do. And having you all be willing to make the schlep from wherever you come from to come talk with us and tell your stories is a pretty powerful reminder to all of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman. And just kind of a statement that I really am hoping that we have an opportunity to take a deeper look at the Fairview Trust and that issue and where those funds went, because I'm quite discouraged to hear that got swept away.
Yep. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank the people who came, also everybody, and especially the caregivers. I'm sure this wasn't your choice of what to do on your day off, so we're taking the day off, so thanks for making the trip down.
Thank you, panel. I want to thank you all for being here today. I especially want to thank the caregivers, some of the people who receive these services, and these two wonderful mothers over here. Mm-hmm. And don't feel bad about having a few tears. I started choking up. We are adjourned. We are adjourned.